You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Good evening. Thank you for tuning in. This is your pal, John Smith, the Weekly Dossier. It is Thursday, October the 5th, 2017. You're listening to RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Got the headset on tonight. Hopefully the audio is okay. And let's see. That was Tom Petty on the intro. Passed away this week. I'd have to admit I was a bigger fan back in high school than, I remember, we talked about, that goes back to high school where, people like, Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and, Bruce Springsteen, they were all in their heyday. And, that's kind of when he broke out with the, Damn the Torpedoes. I remember going to a Tower Records store in New York City and the, back when they used to have those, and they used to have these huge like paintings of album covers, and they had one for him with I think it was a Damn the Torpedoes, the one with the red cover. So that was the breakdown song. That was when we got one of my favorites, I think. I know he's gotten a lot of increased traffic the last few days. Breakdown also, I think it applies to society in general here. You know, I kind of look at a guy like that. You know, like what a full life he's lived, and he's not gonna be around to see hopefully we can avoid it, but the eventual downing of the drain. We'll do what we can to not have that happen, but I want to make a quick show announcement before we move on. I have a lot of material here for tonight and last week. There's going to be some more Hillary audio later, and it's actually going to bleed over into this hour, the printed material, because I'm covering just different aspects. Tonight we're covering pretty much the drug aspect, and then next week we'll be covering the murder aspect. That's going to take even more time if you want to get into the body count or anything. But after next week's show, I'm going to take a hiatus for a little while from doing the weekly shows, and just go back to doing an occasional wild card. We've got a great lineup here, and I'm so happy to see that we've got all these great new hosts. And it took a little longer than I would have liked, but it's nice to see people stepping up. I was great to hear Charles back finally last night. That was kind of the last linchpin for me, but there's not any one reason. And I don't want to be the type of host that keeps going and the show quality of the shows go down. I think I don't have as much preparation time as I'd like for these shows, but I think overall, most of these I'm pretty proud of. Even the one that I like the least, which I won't tell you which one it is, I still listen back to it. And I thought, it's okay. And just to thank you in advance, everybody that had come on the air with me, and any one of you that had kind words to say. It really means a lot, and as it does to the other hosts. Looking at the website, I mean, you can't help but see not just the live chat section here, but where they replay the show comment pages, and pretty much it's dominated by this one person now. That just if it were up to me, but it's not. But I just think that the tone and the language that's used in expressing disagreement with somebody else's opinion is it's not just rude, it's counterproductive, and I think it's that kind of stuff that helps depress people from participating if you're going to get slammed that hard. And most of the whole time, I think a bonus part of doing one more show next week is I think that'll be show number 33, and I know that's such a number that's held in high exultance for the numerology crowd. Not really, but I also wanted to start out let me see how this sounds here. We'll play a quick clip from my prior radio career here.
Lorraine had cracked up a little bit. They backed the motors to the shepherd, just holding it just enough to keep it from the first tender flame. The flame had it falling. It's crazy. Get it started, get this started. It's crazy, it's crazy, terrible. Oh my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between the fifth is terrible. This is one of the worst disasters in the world. Oh, it's crazy, 400 feet into the sky, it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity.
So tonight, other than Hillary, I wanted to talk a little bit about donor privacy. We had a discussion here the other night about the usefulness of trying to protect your identity online. I happen to think any small step that you can take, obviously, if there's people like the large bald fat men who always wear hats and are married to people with sketchy ethics that work at large search engines, they're going to if they target you, they're going to find you. But for the average Joe Schmo here who just wants to be a muckraker, any small steps that you could take on your end as an end user, I hardly endorse. And also, my offer would still stand if any of you do ever want to go on the air and you're just kind of nervous to do it by yourself. If you want somebody to go on, maybe you just get in touch with me. And if you have clips to play, I can play them. Whatever topic you want, I don't really care. And I think we'll still keep doing the music on Wednesdays. It seems to be really popular. I was on for almost 4 hours last night, and was on Monday night too for 4 hours. I've still got hundreds of records I haven't played yet. And for the most part, they've all been really good quality. I'm not really looking at the chat, so I can concentrate on what I'm doing. So I'll catch up on it in the break. So don't think I'm ignoring you. One little quick thing that I meant to get to last week. Every town with a decent size has one of these free rag progressive Democrat weeklies that somehow they don't charge for them, I guess, because they can barely give them away with, gays are great and we love Democrats even though we're independent. And it's funny, I thought that these papers would change, you know, when Obama was in office for 8 years, but the tone never changed. The targets never changed. It was never, well, here we, you know, it's never positive, you know, here we are and here's the steps we can take. And it's just, you know, it's like everywhere else. But they had a full, this issue was dedicated to, I don't know, there's some kind of gay festival here or something. And there's a full page ad for a support group called PFLAG, which I think, it doesn't spell it out here, but I think it's Parents and friends of lesbian and gays. So I don't know how they haven't added more letters to that website, but or to that name, you know, because you've got the alphabet soup now, which is all going according to plan. But they have this whole page full of list of sponsors, and then you know you have about 40 or so individuals, and then if you have the religious institutions, which is a joke to me. I mean, you know, they, if they don't see the irony in it, but under the congregations, the first one listed is a synagogue. Interesting. So, when I talked about privacy, when it gets when you donate money to an organization, your donations, if they're not involved in direct political advocacy, they're supposed to be kept private. Like if you donate to a charity or even an advocacy group, as long as they don't advocate for one particular party, if you still play that game. But there was an article here, and I have a short video that covers the same subject, kind of what we did with the civil asset forfeitures. During the previous presidential administrations, the president, in great Nixonian style, decided to use the IRS to target his enemies, which were any conservative organizations. And of course, that was fine, and there was no big deal made about it by the media. Now, I mean, this is the second place that I've read about the heat being turned up on groups that just even if they're not violating the law, if the powers that be don't like their mission or what they stand for, basically if they have any morals or differing opinions from those that rule us. I don't know. I don't know how many different ways to say it, but this is an article from the local John Locke Foundation. But it talks about a group in New Mexico that localities are now in right think, or not just right living, forcing you what to do. They're taxing things like plastic bags in grocery stores, which replaced paper, which was supposed to be a good thing, but now it's a bad thing. So they tell you to take your totes, and then no people wash their totes, and they're carrying meat in them, and then they end up getting sick because they don't wash the bags out. And soda, they're taxing soda, they're taxing, you know, so it's just, it, sure, maybe, but you're not going to bully people into acting the right way, just like you're not going to bully them into thinking the right way. Which is why I don't like what goes on in these show comment pages. They tend to leave me alone because either I don't make them mad enough or I shut it off that one time and they don't want anyone else to get that idea. I haven't told Bill about that option, but he says it doesn't bother him. So, you know, that's fine. But looks like Richard got a taste of it this week, too. If you disagree with somebody, there's rational cooler head should prevail. But, you know, there's a time and a place. So this article was September 2017. Now, this is a publication of the John Locke Foundation. Paul Gesick wanted to pop the top on Santa Fe's soda tax. That was all. And this is Santa Fe, New Mexico. The president of the Libertarian Rio Grande Foundation never planned to file a lawsuit against the city. But when Santa Fe lawmakers accused him of violating a campaign finance ordinance and demanded to see his donor list, he thought he had no choice. The trouble began in March when Mayor Javier Gonzalez proposed a 2 cent per ounce tax on sugary beverages, including soda, energy drinks, sports drinks, juice boxes, and even sweetened coffee. So you take two cents per ounce. If you buy a, what is it, a quart bottle, or was it a 32 ounce bottle of Coke or whatever, that's it's an extra 64 cents. You know, we're getting into cigarette territory pretty, I mean, don't even get me started on that either. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like $45 for a carton of Marlboros. I think when I quit, it was $1.75 a pack, so like $15, $17. And what is it helping? It's not helping anybody. The revenue would fund a pre-K program for the city. At least this, that's what they were saying. The tax was bad news. The Rio Grande Foundation, policy analyst said beverage prices would explode. The cost of a soda, a 12 pack would nearly double. Low income families would suffer. That used to be Rush's thing where if there was a hurricane or something, the mainstream media headline would be women and children, women and minorities hurt the worst. On April 6th, I'm just going to refer to him as RGF, the Rio Grande Fund. RGF released a website and a video voicing their concerns. The goal is to tell voters what would happen if they greenlighted the plan. The same day they released the video, guess it got a letter from the city's attorneys. They said, if you go ahead with this, you're going to have to disclose your donors. And that's when I kind of freaked out a little bit. The RGF had done nothing illegal by IRS 501c3 nonprofit standards, Gessick said. They weren't campaigning on behalf of a candidate. They weren't engaged in inappropriate advocacy. It was news to me. I was running around with my hair on fire for the next few days trying to figure out what to do going forward because it was totally unexpected. RGF violated a city law passed in 2015 that forces nonprofits to disclose donor information if they campaign on ballot initiatives, city attorney said. So it's not just even candidates. So they're deciding, the city's deciding, they're just, well. So what probably happened was, we have another big transportation bond coming up here, which whenever you hear the word bond out there, you know everything, but whenever you hear the word bond, you just substitute the word tax for it because it will be paid back and it won't be paid back by any mythical profits from any investments. It will be paid by the taxpayer. Gessick appeared before the city ethics board where he was forced to disclose the nonprofit that produced the website and video as well as the name of the donor who funded the project. Slip over here to page 12, pardon me. The RGF decided to keep the website up, but canceled plans for an expensive postcard and social media campaign. Shortly after, Matt Miller, an attorney from the Phoenix-based Goldwater Institute, called Gessick. He said that the law was unconstitutional, and this is the lawyer talking. I told him that we could challenge this law in federal court and have a good probability of winning, he said. So they filed a lawsuit. The RGF's problem is nothing new. Under federal law, organizations classified as 501c3 may participate in limited policy and issue advocacy, but aren't allowed to engage in campaign for political candidates. On the other hand, 501c4 entities may participate in lobbying and political campaigning, provided the majority of their work is focused on public policy and issue advocacy. Now, how gray is that? Although 501c3 nonprofits are prohibited from endorsing or opposing any candidate running for elected office, for decades they've been subject to much scrutiny under federal and local campaign finance laws. The arguments over this issue date back to 1956, when Alabama tried to force the National Association for the Advancement of Liberal Colored People to turn over bank records and donor information. Founded by Jews. Alabama reportedly claimed that the NAACP was breaking a state law requiring foreign corporations to qualify before doing business in the state. The nonprofit based in New York believed it was exempt. Turning over its donor information would be dangerous to supporters and would deter future contributions. Well, not much has changed today. And, you know, I think the point I was kind of getting to just looking at this was direct advocacy of stuff before the voters, how long it's going to be until those that are in power or those who have the noisiest or the noisiest minority decide, well, hey, you donated to Stormfront, or you donated to, you know, it's never going to be you donated to the ACLU. Let's see your name. It's you know which way it's going to go. But a 2-year legal battle ensued, and in 1958, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of, guess who? The NAACP, saying that Alabama's demand violated the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In 2010, Citizens United, a conservative 501c4, challenged the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, also known as McCain-Feingold, preventing corporations or union-funded political ads from airing within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. The organization was blocked from airing a documentary about Hillary Clinton shortly before the 2008 presidential primary. Though the film was critical of Clinton, it did not explicitly tell voters to vote against her. And it goes back to all of the shenanigans with, like we've seen Democrats, like in New Jersey, they've had politicians drop out. I forget what's his name, but he dropped out less than like 40 days before an election. And you had to do, it was either 60 or 90 days. You couldn't replace him, but you know, they found a way to do it. So, you know, it doesn't matter what part of society you look at now. Laws don't matter. Rules don't matter. Traditions don't matter. And common sense doesn't matter. So it's just another example of the just being, you know, under continuous assault from all sides, nonstop, 7 days a week. The enemy never rests. The enemies of truth and freedom. And I don't see it getting any better. I'm, you know, until it's over, there's always hope. The lawsuit that they go into more a little historical stuff, but the RGF, there's a good chance they'll win the lawsuit. On August 24th, the city filed an answer to the case denying that the foundation's conclusion that donor disclosure requirements burden a person's right to free speech. Well, I don't know about a burden, but it certainly has the intimidation factor, which we all know is the point. That's the point of it. We will intimidate you into not donating. We'll intimidate you into shutting up. We'll intimidate you into self-censoring. And then we have a quote from the Santa Fe attorney. The Rio Grande Foundation has alleged no facts to indicate that disclosure of its contributor's name will subject them to threats, harassment, reprisals from either government officials or private parties. Well, maybe not here, but... you know, the next group that's targeted, sure. Once the IRS got a hold of donor lists, all these people all mysteriously started getting audited. I mean, even Rush Limbaugh, he sold his apartment and moved out of the state of New York, and I think he broadcasts there like maybe 1 or 2 days a year now, specifically because of targeted tax shenanigans and audits and the nonstop. And he doesn't even, I think this may still be the case, he doesn't even go overseas anymore, because the last time he did, the customs did the same thing to him, you know. And you may not like the guy, or maybe you never listened to him, but equal treatment under the law is a joke. So the lawsuit is on hold for several months while lawyers on both sides build their cases. No major developments are likely before the beginning of 2018. For now, Gessing and his staff are stuck waiting. The idea of donor privacy is being totally undermined here. If foundation contributors sense a threat to their privacy, they will be far less likely to support them or any other nonprofit. That's the threat to free speech. It's one thing to have campaign or candidate-oriented finance laws. It's another to have ballot measure regulations. And then, you know, you sit down from there, just any organization. That's it's a stepladder. This is kind of the middle step. You can always argue that there's a quid pro quo with the candidate, whereas ballot measures, pass or no pass, isn't going to give us anything on the backside of the issue. We are purely involved in the ballot measure because of the principle. Perception is half the battle for conservative think tanks such as the RGF, which are often branded as mouthpieces for the Koch brothers. This can sometimes evoke hostility from left-leaning politicians. Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez, a Democrat, doesn't necessarily have a vendetta against the RGF, but the organization's libertarian label hasn't helped the situation, Guessing said. I think city officials were probably more gleeful in their enforcement than they would have been otherwise. Gleeful. That's how, you know, for all the way people like these paid bully Antifas, that's how they take to their duties mindlessly and gleefully. Point them in the right direction and tell them who to attack. The Constitution is clear on the issue, Miller said. Governments can't silence nonprofits by threatening the privacy of their donors. It's up to the individuals to decide whether an organization is honest, he said. Groups may choose to make themselves very transparent to gain legitimacy, and it's totally legitimate for listeners and voters to prefer messages from people who are totally transparent. And apparently, Santa Fe residents listened to the RGS video and website. In May, the proposed soda tax fell flat among the voters. I love it. Gesick only hopes that his organization can continue to work as it should. We've been active and involved and taken positions on soda taxes before. It's not like we just rolled out of bed one day and saw this tax and got a big check from the soda industry and said, okay, now we've got to do this. I said, this is the core of what our operations are. We're doing our time. Okay. It's about break time. We'll come back. I got a little video clip for you, a couple other things, and we'll get started on more Clinton stuff. Disgusting. There we go. Be right back.
Most of you are already aware that the sick freaks ruling our world are engaged in some of the most horrific crimes against children imaginable. This dark and depraved underground is something any healthy person would not even want to consider. But we must investigate their operations and expose these criminals to the light of day so that justice might be done. The recent Pizzagate revelations are just the tip of a massive iceberg. Watch The Big Picture, Pizzagate and Beyond. Learn the terrifying truth at beyondpizzagate.com.
We'll be right back.
All right, welcome back. Second segment. Here is a short video. It is less than 5 minutes, covering the topic of nonprofit donor privacy that we just talked about. This is from I forget. They tell you who they are.
The Center to Protect Free Speech focuses on all free speech issues, but specifically we focus on donor privacy, free speech on college campuses, and commercial speech. The hot topic issue right now is definitely around donor privacy. There are multiple bills and policies going through state legislatures right now that are trying to closely monitor and regulate donations and donors and how they interact with our public policy. A lot of people will say that this is about transparency, but really these are bills designed to intimidate people from using their free association rights under the First Amendment to donate and be active in the causes that they believe in. If you'd like to hear more about donor disclosure and the legal implications and arguments around it, you should definitely listen to this clip from Cleta Mitchell.
As legislatures across the country are getting started with their work, there's one issue that seems to be popping up in legislatures all over the country, and that is legislation which is described as bringing transparency to the political process, when in fact, these bills that are being introduced have the opposite effect, and they would require, in many cases, disclosure of donors to nonprofit organizations. Let's talk about why that's a really bad idea. First, we have a First Amendment right as Americans that allows us to join together with other citizens of like mind to promote and advance causes and issues that we care about. We're able to give money to organizations to speak on our behalf about causes and issues we care about. What has been going on for a number of years now is that leftist organizations, George Soros-funded organizations and entities, have been working to try to force disclosure of donors to nonprofit organizations. Now, why would they want to do that? They want to do that because they want a target list of donors to conservative organizations so that they can intimidate and chill the willingness of conservatives to give money to conservative issue groups. That's really what this is about. And we would call on state legislators to remember our First Amendment rights and to reject legislation, any bill that would convert a nonprofit organization to a political committee. That is a really bad idea. And it is code for converting these organizations from issue-based organizations who promote or oppose issues to ones that require disclosure of their donors. And look at these, some of these bills call for redefining what is an independent expenditure. An independent expenditure should be defined by law in the same way the Supreme Court defined it in 1976 in Buckley versus Vallejo. The Supreme Court said that there should be a bright line under the First Amendment so that citizens will know in advance which speech is going to be subject to government regulation and which speech is not going to be subject to government regulation. And when a bill comes to the legislature and it proposes to change the definition and blur that line and to convert independent issue speech into some kind of regulated speech requiring disclosure of donors and that sort of thing, that's a problem under the First Amendment. So we would urge every legislator in America to look at these and not be misled by common cause that really are seeking to violate the First Amendment rights of American citizens. So look at those bills. Be aware of what these really are. These are Trojan horse bills that are meant to silence conservatives. We're looking to conservative state legislators to protect our First Amendment rights.
Okay, that was it. So reinforcing what we were talking about. Somebody let this out on Twitter today. I wanted to save it for tonight instead of tweeting it out, but not on this topic, but about the unfriend to the show, Jeffrey Epstein, of Pizzagate lore. Apparently, three girls are suing him, and they're going to get a hush money totaling $5.5 million. From today's New York Post, billionaire, they call him billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Now, was he convicted? I guess he was. Billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein reportedly paid $5.5 million to settle with three of the more than two dozen teens who sued him. Epstein, who was accused of recruiting dozens of underage girls as sex slaves for his wealthy pals, paid $1 million to one girl named L.M., $2 million to E.W., and $2.5 million to Jane Doe. Wait, can I be Jane Smith? Maybe add me to this lawsuit. Settlement details were disclosed as part of a feud between Epstein and lawyers Bradley Edwards and Scott Rothstein. This is the funny part. Rothstein is serving a 50-year sentence for running a $1.2 billion Ponzi scheme. Epstein had sued the Florida attorneys claiming Edwards, the lawyer who had filed suits on behalf of some of Epstein's accusers, fabricated the sex slave allegations in order to perpetuate Rothstein's Ponzi scheme. Epstein dropped the suit against Edwards and Rothstein in 2012, only to see Edwards sue him for malicious prosecution. Well, he's not really the prosecutor, but okay. Epstein's lawyer, Tanya Haddad Coleman, asked a judge Tuesday for a postponement of the trial set for December, saying she hasn't been able to reach Epstein since Hurricane Irma ravaged his estate on his private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Palm Beach County Circuit Judge Donald Hafele denied the request, citing Epstein's wealth and his private jet. Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to soliciting prostitution from a 14-year-old as part of a plea deal and served 13 months of an 18-month prison sentence. In May, one of his alleged sex slaves, Virginia Guerfery, settled her defamation suit against Epstein's former girlfriend, British socialite Zane Maxwell. That. There's another good one. I don't know if I cut it out or not. Let's see. Can't dawdle too long. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I did. Okay. Darn it. There we go. The Equifax CEO or the ex-CEO was testifying on Capitol Hill, and I saw one guy with a beard that was dressed up as the Monopoly guy with the top hat, but I guess there was some girl that was there too. It didn't look as impressive, but they got the monocle and the mustache twirled down. But there was this little exchange during the hearing that I thought was pretty funny. During Wednesday's hearing, lawmakers expressed bewilderment at the IRS's award of a $7.25 million contract to Equifax for taxpayer and personal identity verification services. Senator Ben Smith of Nebraska asked the CEO, "Why in the world should you get a no-bid contract right now?" SAS's indignation was topped by Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, who said, "You realize to many Americans right now, that looks like we're giving Lindsay Lohan the keys to the minibar." So I thought that was pretty funny. And what it turned out to be was, it was a previously agreed to contract, and the IRS claims they're looking for another vendor, blah, 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 blah. So let's see. Okay. Okay. So, this is going to get into the drug section of the Clinton. This will lead to our audio clip 3 of 4. It's very long. The audio clip's a little longer, so it'll take a little more than the last segment. So I'm going to start. This is from volume two of the Clinton trilogy by Victor Thorne, who bothered me. It bothered me that he was one of the guys that I really wanted to interview. That I would have loved to interview, but he didn't make it. So a good part of this book talks about the drug collection or drug connection in the 80s that ran through Arkansas, where drugs from Central America were transported, and then in Arkansas, they were distributed throughout the nation. And this was allegedly set up through what was called the Dixie Mafia, where you had the all these people involved, including the Tyson Chicken. And he gets into a lot of this. But there's my sheet there. I don't want to run over. If you're familiar with the name Barry Seal, you would know the part of the upcoming. They just made a movie. I have no intention of seeing it, but Tom Cruise playing Barry Seal. But he was a guy that was used to transport the drugs and ended up getting killed. He's one of the early numbers of the count, the body count. He may even be in the single digits of it. But this part, I wanted to start out with, introduces Mr. Tyson. I forget his first name. I should have wrote it down. Well, it'll be in here. Anyway, Big Daddy Tyson was one of the ones that, I know, I looked it up in the index. There we go. That's how I tracked all this stuff down anyway. Don't you hate books that don't have Don Tyson. There we go. Okay. This section talks about, of course, a lot of their Clinton escapades have been made into jokes, you know, by the media. It's old news and they will make jokes about it, you know, like the blue stained dress and the cigar in the vagina and the, he got in trouble, so he got a dog, and don't neuter the dog, neuter the president, ha, ha, ha. And this part talks about Hillary's $1,000 investment into cattle futures that turned a profit of $100,000. If you've never heard about it, this section will briefly talk about it. And this gets into the area of who's really calling the shots, and the state trooper will talk about that in the audio recording. So I don't want to do too much over that, but basically Hillary calls the shots. But Bill couldn't give a shit about anything other than chase a tail, really. You know, to this day. You know, he's looking like the crypt keeper lately. All right. So Tyson and company realized that since Hillary called the shots, the only way they can make her an official member of the Arkansas cabal was to initiate her through a criminal act. Which brings us to an incident which has plagued Mrs. Clinton for over two decades. Her miraculous transformation of $1,000 into $100,000 literally overnight. To be fair, I'm not sure Hillary even realized at the time what type of web was being woven around her. Sure, she enjoyed the quick riches, and of course, it made their daily financial situation much easier. But in that one single moment, Hillary had been changed into a criminal. In Hollywood movies, the protagonist always has a twinge of guilt and suddenly alters his terrible ways. But in Arkansas politics, things aren't quite so easy. Hillary was now in. She was a part of them, and there was absolutely no turning back. These guys play for keeps, and they don't play nice. How, you may wonder, did Hillary turn a mere $1,000 into $100,000? And you know what? I believe that... she didn't need it. It was $1,000 wasn't even actually her money. I don't think he goes into that here, but yeah. good night, Urban Jungle Girl, my friend. Thank you. Thank you for helping me on my way. Hold on tight because it's one blockbuster story. Between October 1978 and July 1979, Hillary Clinton, a woman who had practically no experience with the stock market, supposedly invested $1,000 in cattle futures, another area that she had absolutely no experience in, and walked away with $99,537. What are the odds against such a move? And I got a couple of bullet points here. Hillary's 10,000% rate of return far outstrips the personal best of George Soros, who across 20 years never achieved better than a 122% rate. In 1995, economists at Auburn and North Florida University ran a sophisticated computer statistical model of the First Lady's trades for publication in the Journal of Economics and Statistics, using all available records as well as market data from the Wall Street Journal. The probability of Hillary Rodham having made her trades legitimately, they calculated, was less than 1 in 250 million. Look at it this way, using one of the hottest stocks of the last decade as a gauge. By way of comparison, had Hillary instead invested $1,000 in the first offering of Microsoft stock in 1986, she would have made $35,835 by March 1994. Yet she cleared $100,000 in only 9 months. The premier technology investment of our times, therefore, pales in comparison to what she had made on the world's oldest commodity, livestock. The likelihood of such a return on such an investment was close to lottery odds, 24 chances in a million. The known details of the transactions defied belief. Her purchases and sales were consistently made at virtually the most favorable prices of the day. If legitimate, the odds against such prescience and mastery would have been about the same as those of finding the Dead Sea Scrolls on the steps of the State House in Little Rock. How did Hillary pull off such an astounding feat? According to her, I was lucky, she said with a shrug when asked to explain her good fortune. There you go, it was nothing but luck. But this feat so defied description that Mark Powers, editor of the Journal of Futures Markets, likened it to buying ice skates one day and entering the Olympics a day later. When those in the know pressed for answers, Hillary would later claim that by simply reading Barron's and the Wall Street Journal, she became an overnight whiz at commodities trading. And, you know, the funny thing about this is like any one of these, you know, I could do this for another year, just go through one different scumbag maneuver of theirs at a time. At any one of them, normal people would be locked up, disgraced, bankrupted. And it doesn't happen. A lot of times we've seen where politicians no longer are of any use, or even celebrities, you know, and then they're discarded and disgraced, and that has just never happened, and it's very odd. Today we know these statements are untrue thanks to one of the Clintons' old pals who have been ripped off by them, namely Jim McDougal, the late Jim McDougal. March 1994, Jeff Gerth of the New York Times, tipped off by McDougal, broke the story of the commodities future trading profits Hillary earned in the late 1970s. McDougal, then a close friend of the Clinton, said at the time, "Several things troubled me. I knew fortunes were made and lost overnight in commodity trading, but the magnitude of her return and the tidy number, 100,000, defied belief." At this juncture, circumstances get very sticky because Hillary, backed into a corner, was exposed not only as the beneficiary of these highly questionable trades, but also as a bold-faced liar. Ms. Rodham didn't make the transaction on her own, rather. Her investment advisor was James Blair, counsel to Tyson Foods. The broker of record at Refco in the Springdale, Arkansas branch was Redbone, who had previously worked for Tyson Foods. Jim Blair, it appears, was not just any acquaintance of off the street. Instead, he was a Springdale attorney for the Arkansas's Tyson Foods and other agribusiness giants, who was even closer to Clinton than Jim McDougal. It's also helpful to know that the connections of the commodities of her commodities mentor, Jim Blair, to Tyson and the Clintons has also raised eyebrows. This is especially true because the largest employer in Arkansas, Tyson Foods, has been uncomfortably close to Bill Clinton. When the trades were made, Jim Blair was then chief outside attorney for Tyson Foods. The common denominator running through this entire scenario is, of course, Tyson Foods. But we have to ask, why would Big Daddy Don Tyson, owner of a company that was the world's largest poultry producer at the time, stick his neck out to make $100,000 for Hillary Clinton, the much disliked wife of first-term Governor Bill Clinton? Well, it seems Tyson Foods is having quite a few environmental problems at its poultry processing plants, especially with, quote, tons of chicken feces that the plant dumped into nearby dry creek, unquote. The result was that the runoff chicken feces ultimately filtered into the town drinking water, sickening local residents and forcing Governor Clinton to declare the locality a disaster area. But because Hillary was rewarded with a $100,000 kickback, here's what's transpired. During the Clinton era, Tyson's company benefited from millions of dollars in state loans, tax breaks, and the relaxation of environmental regulations. He, Tyson, received an $8 million in tax concessions for the plant and workforce concessions, as well as $900,000 in state grant monies to rebuild roads and upgrade sites. So that's probably, when I talk about roads, it's probably roads leading from the public roads to the plants. Yes, Weeking. It's these books, you can get them cheaper online rather than buy them from American Free Press sells them, but I actually paid $60 for all three, but you can get them online too. They're, if you can stand it, I've been following these scumbags for, you know, 20, 25 years or longer, and there's stuff in here that I didn't know. So all this stuff that he got, it's not too bad for dropping $100,000 in the first lady's lap. Still, Hillary said her $100,000 bonanza was simply good luck. But as Barbara Olson concluded, unless you believe in good fairies, luck had nothing to do with it. It is pretty obvious that Hillary had something better than luck. She had well-placed friends who wanted her to have $100,000. And I mentioned that before, that Barbara Olson, her Hillary book was called Hell to Pay. I don't have a copy of it anymore, but if you're interested, it's a good read, and you can get it on Amazon, I'm sure, for a dollar or two. She was allegedly on the plane that hit the Pentagon or one of them, whatever. But she was good. She was in the, it was back in those days, it was her and Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham, and I think there was one other one. There were all these blonde, like, conservative commenter assassins. And they were quite a troop. Let's take it a step further. Many of Clinton's political enemies believe that the scheme was designed to surreptitiously transfer an illegal bribe or gratuity to Clinton in exchange for political favor or for political influence. They believe Don Tyson, a major supporter of Clinton, was the benefactor. Well, of course. All right, so we'll skip over here a little bit. Conveniently for Bill Clinton, these allegations were never pursued because the request to widen a probe that was underway was shut down by Attorney General Janet Reno, another one of Bill Clinton's handpicked cronies. But what of the gentleman who actually placed the trades, Mr. Redbone? At first, he said in an early statement that he had never dealt with Mrs. Clinton in his life. But then it turns out this same Robert Redbone was a former truck driver and personal bodyguard for Don Tyson, who was a, quote, high-stakes gambler with a questionable reputation around Fayetteville. That's Fayetteville, Arkansas. Yeah, I'm going to get to Maine is coming up. On top of that, it seems Mr. Bone couldn't keep his hands in clean. In 1979, he was handed $250,000, a $250,000 fine by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for violation of sundry procedures, the largest ever imposed for commodity trading violations. So I think you get the point. We'll move on. I always think these sections are easier, that I'm going to be able to read faster. So then there's a brief section where they talk about the Dixie Mafia, the Rose Law Firm. It doesn't exist anymore, but I actually was in front of it one time. I took a picture of it. Dixie Mafia formed a ring of interlocking interests that covered Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Tennessee, and above all, Arkansas. Their spiritual capital was Bill Clinton's hometown of Hot Springs, famous for its racetrack, its ornate bathhouses, its casinos, its prostitution, and its epic defiance of prohibition. So then a little more, how are we doing on time there? A little more on Don Tyson. Oh, geez, we're almost at break already. All right. Even though we already know how much Don Tyson's poultry plants polluted the state, less notorious but even more toxic are the pulp plants of International Paper, Georgia Pacific, and the James River. And then, of course, you get into Walmart was another big player. Despite all the influence wielded by the above entities, there were three primary hands-on forces responsible for the rise of Bill and Hillary Clinton. So we have the first is the man, Don Tyson, and they're going to talk about him. So we'll talk about him a little more when we get to the break. I don't want to run out of time, so I want to get to Mina. I've got this bookmark, but we've got just a couple of pages about Mr. Tyson. Yeah, it's just, I mean, and Hillary working for the law firm. Well, I'll just summarize it. Hillary worked for this Rose law firm. She never prosecuted anything. They talk about her actually what she did in the courtroom, which is a joke. She never won any cases or anything. And her law firm helped facilitate a lot of this monkey business that went on with the Tyson chain, the Tyson Foods, and just helped grease the wheels and facilitate all this stuff and prepare all the paperwork. So the law firm and her working for the law firm, you know, she claims, well, wasn't getting any paid anything for work that I did that involved the state government, you know, and that's more bullshit. We'll be right back.
Don't let the sun catch you crying. Tonight's the time for all your tears. Your heart may be broken tonight, but tomorrow in the morning light, don't let the sun catch you crying. The nighttime shadows disappear.
And the mainstream media only ever gives us one side of World War II. They don't want us to know the real history of what happened over 70 years ago, seeing through the eyes of the German victims. The horror of the terror bombing, the mass rape of millions of women and children, the torture and murder of civilians, the death camps for surrendered soldiers, the ethnic cleansing of whole countries, and the planned extermination of the entirety of the German people. After watching Hellstorm, you'll never see the good war and the good guys in the same light ever again. Watch for free and get DVDs at hellstormdocumentary.com.
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Quick cough. Welcome back to Hour 2. This is the Weekly Dossier. You're listening to RenegadeBroadcasting.com. It's Thursday, October 5th, 2017. We were in the middle of talking about Clinton involvement in corruption and drug crimes. We will now turn our focus to the town of Mena, Arkansas. I'm going to get right to it because this is going to introduce you to Barry Seal. He was one of the pilots that ran the drugs back and forth across the border for distribution throughout the country with the permission and cooperation of federal authorities. Elite deviance. One of the harshest indictments, not to mention the most unforgivable acts on their part, was the Clintons' direct participation in bringing vast quantities of drugs into America via a remote airstrip in Mena, Arkansas. In this chapter, we present an overwhelming amount of evidence that proves that the Clintons were involved in allowing illegal drugs into the U.S. This felonious conduct should disqualify either of them from ever holding any public office, you would think. The proper punishment for Bill and Hillary would have been / is a long prison sentence. As we already learned, since the 1950s, a, quote, secret team of former military and intelligence officers had been engaged in an international criminal conspiracy, a conspiracy involving drug smuggling, gun running, and money laundering, with the support of some U.S. officials. As it turned out, several of the defendants named in the Christic Institute lawsuit were the same ones named in the emerging Iran-Contra scandal. The suit, and it's funny that, yeah, there's so much cross-pollination, but nobody, you know, nobody really connected it at the time. And even with the Democratic media, today is a lot worse, but even then there were places that were just no-go that you didn't know. The suit alleged that proceeds from the sale of cocaine by the Colombian drug cartel were used to buy guns, which were then flown to Nicaragua. Now that, you know, just like when we talk about Watergate, I don't want to get sidetracked. We got to keep going. Just suffice to say that, you know, Fall Guys fell and it just stopped at a certain point. Facts got out, but there's no, even a scumbag like Elliot Ambrose, who's still in government today, you know, he was knee deep in all this. Now look him up. These drugs were flown into Mena, Arkansas, that became in the 1980s one of the world centers of the narcotics trade and the base of what many believed was the single largest cocaine smuggling operation in U.S. history. Mena is a small town of 5,000 or so souls in far western Arkansas that is tucked away in the farthest corner of one of the hardest to get to places in the lower 48 contiguous states. Despite its meager population and rural locale, Mena was attached to an international airport, which possessed a lengthy runway and cavernous hangars designed for large continental range aircraft. named the Intermountain Regional Airport, this was obviously no ordinary landing field. The facility was state-of-the-art installation. Plus, all the aircraft were equipped with the most expensive cryptic radio communications we have ever seen, said DEA agent Eric Jacobson. Why would one of the sleepiest backwater hamlets in rural America need an international airport with state-of-the-art equipment? How many people vacation in the hotspot tourist mecca of Mena, Arkansas? How many have ever even heard of Mena, Arkansas? How many dot-on-the-map towns with a population of 5,000 or less have international airports with such sophisticated equipment? Yeah, okay. Does the entire scenario smell a little fishy to you? I don't want to mark up the book. It should, especially when you realize that, quote, Mena accounted for billions in drugs and arms, and that the very name of the small town would become synonymous with the larger dark side of American politics, and that there was collusion and cover-up implicating three U.S. presidents, including Bill Clinton. And, you know, I'm surprised that they actually made a movie about this. I'm sure it only goes so far. Like the Air America movie, but before that, I don't think most of these younger people would even really, unless you really did a lot of research, would even know about all this. Mena isn't a conspiracy theory, it's fact. Former Arkansas State Police investigator Russia Welsh has been quoted as saying he believed Arkansas was a main thoroughfare in which most of the flow of drugs from Central America entered the United States in the 1980s. In Welsh's words, now we know that there were hundreds of millions of dollars worth of cocaine coming into the small state of Arkansas in the 1980s. These allegations are confirmed by one of the most damning intel reports ever released, where startling revelations in Volume 2 of CIA Inspector General Frederick Hitz's report on allegations of connections between CIA and the Contras and cocaine trafficking to the United States. The Volume 2 Hitz report depicts, in no uncertain terms, involvement in drug smuggling by U.S. intelligence contract agents and their assets in Central America in the 80s, especially Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and the other folks with strong contacts with George H.W. Bush. Tragically, this information has never been disseminated on a large-scale basis to the American public by our controlled corporate media. Speaking of which, whenever you hear news reports on TV or the radio about how many drugs are smuggled into America, do you ever wonder, how do they get this into the country? There has to be a specific spot. After all, the drugs don't just simply appear in the dealer's pocket on the street corner. They have to have some centralized point of origin. Well, in the 1980s, Mena was that spot, and the Clintons oversaw it, along with Oliver North and a few other cronies associated with George Bush Sr. Quite simply, Mena was the port of entry and distribution center for much of the supply of illegal drugs entering the America throughout the 1980s. It was also described as being the, quote, work of former CIA operatives, military men, organized crime figures, and other beltway bandits, which means former U.S. officials, who worked together on various projects. What kind of projects? Arms manufacturing and weapons sales, money laundering, procurement fraud, and kickbacks. The whole laundry list. What we're looking at is the scandal of what sociologists call elite deviance, a condition which exists when the elite in a society begin to believe that the rules no longer apply to them. Yeah, well, how long has that been the case? I mean, this goes back there over 30 years. Think it's any better today? No. Scandal in contemporary U.S. life is an institutionalized sociological phenomenon, states Professor David Simon in Elite Deviance. I guess this is not due primarily to psychopathological variables, but to the institutionalization of elite wrongdoing, which has occurred since 1963. Many of the scandals that have occurred in the U.S. since 1963 are fundamentally interrelated. That is, the same people and institutions have been involved. And you know that I think if you're a JFK guy, I don't really get too far into it, but I guess that Bush and Ford and Nixon were all in Dallas that day. One of the three has denied it, or they've tried to obfuscate it. Pretty interesting. We made the point earlier, there's a clear line of connecting the Bay of Pigs to the Kennedy assassination, from the Golden Triangle drug trafficking up through Watergate, Iran-Contra, and MENA. This elite deviancy was a fact of life in Razorback country. For Arkansas is a corrupt one-party state. What's less known is that it is also a major point for transshipment of drugs coming from Latin America and the Caribbean. Yeah, when they talk about Bill Clinton and his father and the involvement that I can't get into. I really recommend these books very highly. I'm going to skip ahead to we're going to talk about. I have to start the audio before this next break because it's too long. Let's talk about prepare yourself for some of the nastiest evidence of government sanctioned wrongdoing you've ever encountered. So we'll talk about Barry Seal here. The man who put MENA on the map was smuggler extraordinaire Barry Seal, a, quote, renegade pilot and freelance intelligent agent who had become a major drug smuggler and gun runner in the netherworld where government and crime were joined. In one of the most famous articles ever written on the subject, respected authors Sally Denton and Roger Morris provide an excellent overview. And a quote from this. Barry Seal carried on one of the most lucrative, extensive, and brazen operations in the history of international drug trade. And he did it with the evident complicity, if not collusion, of elements of the U.S. government, apparently with the acquiescence of the Reagan administration, impunity from any subsequent exposure by George Bush's administration, and under the usually acute political nose of then governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. Amazingly, in America, a country with supposedly free press, this article, The Crimes of MENA, was scheduled to appear in the Washington Post after having cleared the legal department for all possible questions of inaccurate statements. The article was scheduled for publication when, just as the presses were about to run, Washington Post managing editor Bob Kaiser, like George Bush, a member of the infamous Skull and Bones fraternity, killed the article without explanation. Why did the Post censor the story? Because if its publishers had gone ahead with it, the story would have confirmed and legitimized the persistent reports of drug smuggling, gun running, and money laundering tracing back to the 1980s when Seal based his aircraft at MENA's Intermountain Regional Airport. So then they got up a number of bullet points here about Mr. Seal. Seal was smuggling, what follows undeniable proof, Seal was smuggling drugs and kept his planes at MENA, the Wall Street Journal reported in 1984. He also acted as an agent for the DEA. Phone records indicate Seal made repeated calls to MENA the day before his murder. This was long after Seal, according to his own testimony, was working as an $800,000 a year informant for the federal government. Double agent. I remember that part of it now. Oh, that, okay. Yeah, he really, he had everything. Yeah, I guess it is like a movie, but a former member of the, but knowing, going in forearmed to see something like that, knowing what knowing the facts beforehand and then seeing how they change them, that's kind of interesting part. A former member of the Army Special Forces, Seal, has ties to the CIA dating back to the early 1970s. He had confided to relatives and others, according to sworn statements, that he was a CIA operative before and during his period when he established his operations at MENA. A source deep inside the U.S. government has stated, Barry's been a spook since 1971. In fact, Barry goes all the way back to the Bay of Pigs. The IRS determined that money earned by Seal between 1984 and 1986 was not illegal because of his, quote, CIA-DEA employment, unquote. FAA registration records confirm the aircraft identified by federal and state narcotics agents used in the Seal smuggling operation were previously owned by Air America Incorporated, widely reported to have been a CIA proprietary company. Let's see. Boy, Victor Thorne was nothing if not not thorough. Excuse me. Cough button for a second. Okay, thank you. Sorry. Should have green water, but I'm going to drink coffee instead. Much of the work Seal performed for the CIA and also for the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency Recorded records reportedly showed him on the payroll beginning in 1982 would be burned in Washington buried in Washington secrecy. It burned. May as well have burned it. In 1972, he lost his TWA job when he was caught by U.S. Customs trying to smuggle 7 tons of plastic explosives to anti-Castro Cubans in Mexico. The case was quietly dropped on the pretext of, quote, national security. Before TWA, he had been involved in the 1960s with the U.S. Special Army Forces and had already established contacts with the Central Intelligence Agency. Another account confirms this report. Attorney Sam Dalton charges that Seal was caught, quote, smuggling drugs red-handed at the docks in Louisiana, and the DEA and CIA showed up and told the state police to butt out and took over the operation. It is not known if the DEA or CIA ever made efforts to charge Seal for this crimes, but he wouldn't bet on it. When questioned by federal prosecutors about his income, Seal said that he was working for the CIA and the DEA, and that he imported 1,500 pounds of cocaine since going to work for the DEA. American Free Press reporter Pat Shannon adds that as a teenager, Seal was trained in the same Civil Air Patrol group with Lee Harvey Oswald by David Ferry, a notorious CIA operative, later tied to the JFK assassination. Wow. All right, so we will take a break right there. And I'm going to start this audio and pick it up after the break. When the break is over, we will get through the rest of the thing about Mr. Seal, and we will save another interesting cat named Dan Lasseter for next week. I may just have to do the whole 2 hours on this. Interesting books. R.I.P. Victor Thorne.
He'll start writing quite frequently. His own brother.
His brother.
Somehow his brother was able to keep it from him that he was doing all of this cocaine?
Well, I don't know, but he had a number of friends. Dan Lasseter, for one, who was convicted along with Roger. In fact, Roger Clinton was responsible for Dan Lasseter's conviction. And Dan Lasseter was not convicted of distributing cocaine.
Dan Lasseter was a friend of Bill Clinton's, was a financial wheeler dealer in Little Rock, a bond dealer. He started as a young man in the Ponderosa steakhouses. Very successful, extremely bright, ambitious individual.
That is correct.
Who had somehow made a friendship, acquaintanceship. The way Bill Clinton tells it, he barely knew Dan Lasseter. And of course, the press doesn't ask Clinton much about this. Well, like anything serious about Bill Clinton. But Dan Lasseter was a cocaine dealer, a cocaine distributor, a man that used cocaine. He apparently also had sex with underage girls. That was in the grand jury record when he was convicted.
Correct.
And maybe you could shed, again, some light for us on what the relationship was between Bill Clinton and Dan Lasseter.
Well, it was a close personal relationship, Chris. He worked in all the campaigns prior to his being convicted on the recreational use of cocaine. But Dan Lasseter had access and to Bill Clinton. And
what type of access? Describe it.
Well, there was a 10, 12 people that any time up until midnight, 1 o'clock, could have access to Bill Clinton. All they had to do was call and say, "Tell Bill I'm coming by," or "Get Bill on the phone." And those 10, 12 people, any time, and you were told that any time these people called, you put them through. So
Dan was one of them.
Dan Lasseter was one of them.
Could he go into the mansion anytime he wanted?
He had access. He could. If it was in reasonable hours, midnight or before midnight, yes, he could access the governor's mansion.
And Patsy Thomason, who was Dan Lasseter's executive assistant, was later brought to the White House and was put in charge of a number of positions there.
She was appointed to the Highway Commission by Bill Clinton.
This was a woman that ran Lasseter's business while Lasseter was in federal prison for drug charges.
She had power of attorney for Dan Lasseter.
And then Clinton put her in charge of, among other things, White House security clearances.
Right.
As a law enforcement officer, separate yourself from your personal relationships and knowledge. Is this bothersome to you? You see, did the birds of a feather flock together? Or should we not make any verdict here of guilt by association?
No. If, not knowing any of these players, just being in law enforcement and looking at this, Chris, that would be, you know, an immediate red flag that these are the people that you would not want in charge of White House security. Probably the second most secure building in Washington, D.C. is the White House. Probably number one is the Pentagon. Number two is the White House. So, you know, yeah, but she's in charge of security and doing security clearances. That doesn't make sense.
And Lassiter, apparently, even after he went to jail, there was still a relationship with Clinton. Clinton later pardoned him for any straight state crimes, so he could get all the bond license again.
Right.
But then Clinton came to you and had an interesting conversation, I understand.
He told me, said, Larry, I've got a really good friend that I would really like to appoint as chief of staff, but he's had some really, really bad problems, and I'm afraid if I do, it might hurt me politically. And he said he's had some problems with drugs, and I said, if that's the case, I think that would be political suicide.
So he was thinking about bringing Dan Lassiter into the major political position in his administration.
Correct.
This for a man who they later claimed they barely knew.
That they barely knew, right.
How sure. Convenient. It seems like Clinton also had other associations with organized crime figures in Arkansas. There is a man who we both know his name. We won't say it on this interview, right. Who's reputed to be the head of the Dixie Mafia. Dixie Mafia, as I understand it, is the old boy network down there who used to run alcohol back in the old days of when there was dry counties and wet counties, just like out of one of those Burt Reynolds films.
And this, you know, the Arkansas State Police has intelligence files that's unbelievably thick on all of these players and all of these people that are involved in the Dixie Mafia. And yes, this person we're talking about name is always at the top of the list.
Okay,
and
his first name is Harry.
Okay,
right. Okay,
and but he was a contributor to the Clinton campaign. He sent a lot of Christmas gifts to the governor's mansion for the Clintons. So yes,
anything special for Christmas?
A lot of liquor.
So Clinton had a personal relationship with him.
Yes. Yes.
Again, was this bothersome to you as a law enforcement?
Yes, it did. That upset me. That bothered me. But you know, like we said, Chris, you know, this man was just one of a few that.
Well, there have been many allegations made about Don Tyson of Tyson Chicken. There was a federal investigation of Tyson.
Right.
He admitted wrongdoing in some things related to Mike Espy.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton was close with Tyson. Described that relationship.
Yeah, we had gone to Don Tyson's house in West Little Rock he had a bunch of friends and he wanted Clinton to come to dinner. So we went to dinner at Don Tyson's house and I happened to be sitting and he invited me to sit at the table. And I sat next to Don Tyson at the dinner table. Clinton sat down the table three or four places. And then as the evening progressed, Don Tyson asked me, he said, Larry, do you like to fish? And I said, certainly I do. And he said, well, I've got a couple of boats just off the Baja in California. He said, I've got a 30-footer and I've got a 60-footer. He said, if you'd like to come out and go deep-sea fishing, bill fishing, he said, call me. He said, the plane will pick you up here in Little Rock, fly you out there. You can fish a day, a week, however long you want to, and we'll fly you back whenever you're ready to come back. So I said, thanks, Don. I really appreciate that. So as we were leaving the residence, Bill Clinton was standing just outside the door. I was standing inside the door. Don Tyson was right beside me. And as we're getting ready to leave, he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Larry, I really meant what I said about the fishing trip. Let me know what you want to do. We get in the car and back out of the drive when we're leaving. And he said, Clinton says to me, Larry, what was that all about? And I said, well, Don Tyson invited me to go fishing with him on the Baja. He said, well, let me explain something to you. He said, Don Tyson's a close, close personal friend of mine and one of my biggest contributors. But he said, there's a side of Don Tyson that you don't know about. And he said, if you've done that, I'm afraid that you would be required to do some things that you would not want to do. I said, enough said. I don't need to go fishing.
One of Tyson's pilots for one of his company's planes alleged, and again, this was never substantiated, at least publicly and not substantiated, that Tyson made cash bribes to Bill Clinton, that the pilot would ferry down on the plane to Little Rock Airport, wads of cash and envelopes, And then there would be state troopers at the Little Rock Airport to pick up the cash and deliver it to Clinton. Do you have any direct knowledge of these cash payments?
On 2 to 3 occasions, and maybe as many as 4, I picked up packages from the Tyson plane, from the Little Rock Airport, from Midcoast, and I did not open them. I do not know what the contents were. I was just told Tyson's plane's coming in, Larry. Go to the airport, pick up, there's some paperwork, there's some stuff that needs to be picked up. I would pick it up and deliver it back.
You were not the only trooper that to have done this.
Oh, no, there was many of the troopers on the detail done
and
the same thing.
Did any of them indicate anything suspicious?
I never talked to them about it.
Right.
There has been some occasions, Chris, where I picked up envelopes were handed to me by Bill Clinton or by a contributor where money was, there was money or in checks in those envelopes.
Cash. How much was the most you ever saw?
We were on a trip to Denver, Colorado, and we went to a number of receptions. There were 7 or 8 receptions that night. Each reception, I was handed an envelope. One of those envelopes was open. There was a large amount of cash. There were several $100 bills in there. I'd say $2,000 to $3,000. There was a number of checks. Some of the checks is as much as 30. I looked at some of those checks. They were made payable to Bill Clinton for as much as $35,000 each.
We focused a lot on Bill Clinton, but the really key person in this relationship, really, it seems almost the driving force, is Hillary Clinton.
Correct. In the time I spent around them, Chris, I never saw this lady ever really enjoy herself. I never saw her let her hair down and just have a good time. She's the most driven person I have ever been around in my life.
More driven than he is?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
He's pretty driven.
What?
Two Chris, hours of sleep a night?
Chris, Bill Clinton's was, you know, which woman am I going to sleep with next? Or, you know, what can these people do for me? She was the most focused person I've ever been around in my life. I think she wanted the presidency as much or more than Bill Clinton wanted it.
Did she have relationships outside her marriage? There have been rumors about this. A book was published suggesting she had an affair with Vince Foster, and I'd like to talk to him about him a little bit later in the conversation. But were there other relationships outside of her marriage?
Yes, the one with Vince Foster, I don't know about any other relationships other than this one, Chris, but there is no doubt in my mind that there was a long, ongoing sexual relationship between Hillary Clinton and Vince Foster.
Anyone else other than Vince Foster that you know of?
Don't have any other knowledge of that. I personally saw, you know, Vince Foster put his hands on her breast, on her butt, look over at me, give me the high sign and a big grin. And she did not protest. She did not move away from him. It was very apparent that those touches and was welcomed.
The incident where he put his hands on her breast, where did this take place? When?
It was at her birthday party at Alouette's restaurant in West Little Rock. They had rented the restaurant that evening, and there was 30 or 40 people there. And she told me to sit in the bar. You know, I couldn't sit with the dinner party. So I was sitting.
Good puppy.
Heel. And so, so I was seated in the bar, and that's where the bathrooms were located, was in the bar area of the restaurant. So she was standing, and so Vince walked by to go to the men's room and put his hands on her breast, and then walked back by and grabbed her by the butt and looked over at me and gave me the old high sign and thumbs up. And
the other troopers told stories, apparently, of a relationship or
meetings,
meetings yes. away from home, meetings.
Yeah. And it was common practice when Bill Clinton left town that the first visitor to the governor's mansion would be Vince, or Hillary would be out the gate and out till very late hours of the evening.
You mentioned in a previous conversation that we had that Bill and Hillary Clinton also would frequently argue with one another using the worst expletives known to mankind at each other, sometimes in the presence of their daughter Hillary, daughter Chelsea. And one of the comments you said was an epithet that they frequently use about Jews.
It was fairly common, for both of them to tell ethnic jokes and use ethnic slurs.
What was the particular epithet they would use to each other
a Jew motherfucker, a Jew bastard.
They would refer that to each other in the presence of troopers.
Oh, yeah, that was quite common. And then,
why do you think they would do that? What was their?
I don't know.
Did they make other comments about Jews?
Bill Clinton was fascinated with Adolf Hitler,
there's a couple of things going on here. They would make these clearly anti-Semitic epithets to one another.
Correct.
Right. Put downs. And this was done over the course of 6 years. You heard it
right
enough that you knew that it was fairly commonplace between the two of them. Did they exchange, did Bill have a lot of anti-Semitic humor?
A lot of jokes were made about the Jewish people. That was quite common for Jewish jokes to be told.
Hillary made them as well. Or was Bill the joke?
It was mainly him. And he had a head full of trivia and jokes. Most of them with some sexual connotation, but he told a number of Jewish jokes.
It's interesting because in the Lewinsky tapes and transcripts, Lewinsky details to Linda Tripp that Clinton was telling some jokes about Jews. And Lewinsky, being Jewish, got a big kick out of it, and she gave him a joke about Jews. So apparently he's interested in Jewish humor, which for some people would be political suicide to go around and make jokes about not only Jews, but any ethnic group.
True. But it just wasn't the Jewish community that he made jokes about. And, he was, when it was convenient or he was upset at someone in the black community, he would use the N-word.
Yeah, well, you had mentioned that, too. But let's go back over this, the anti-Semitism issue. One of the things that I've spoken to Roger Perry, the other trooper, about this as well, and he said, Clinton did have this interest in Adolf Hitler and the book Mein Kampf, and it said some praiseworthy things. And can you relate some of your discussions with Clinton on this?
Just that, that he had read the book and that he was
Mein Kampf,
he was very, very intrigued with the book and with the man.
What did he say about the man?
Chris, that I just remember the conversation. I do not remember verbatim what it was, but that he was interested and had read the book, and he discussed it. That he had read it and that he was interested in this man, and that the man had so much power over these people, and that it had just been a short period of time since World War I where they'd been defeated, and this man had come forward, and he had rallied the German people, and that's the part that he was interested in.
I spoke to Perry, and Perry said that he recalled Clinton saying that he was a great man in the sense that he was a great man of history, and that he didn't say that he supported the Holocaust,
right,
or any attacks on Jews, but that he saw this as some great political leader who had, as you said, rallied the Germans.
Yeah, that was my take on it, Chris, is what I got out of the conversation, that he was fascinated about the way that this man could rally a nation, so soon after a defeat in a world war.
He also, you mentioned, used the N-word. There was an incident during the 1992 campaign when he was first running for president. There was anger that Clinton had towards Jesse Jackson and felt that Jackson had backstabbed him.
Right.
And had not come through on a promise. And he was pretty angry, and he said to one or more of the troopers, some of his anger came out.
And this, he used the N-word. And he would also do it.
In other words, he called Jesse Jackson a nigger.
Right. And it's, when we had political leaders in the state, black political leaders, and they and he disagreed with them, then it was frequent that he would use the N-word.
He would use it in the meetings with the black.
No. After he got out of the meetings, there was one man in Little Rock, Say McIntosh, who uh, you know, printed all kind of flyers about Bill Clinton. And so it was, and he, there was a lot of confrontations between, say, McIntosh.
Say, McIntosh was one of the activists in the African-American community.
Black activist. And Little Rock.
He was angry with Clinton.
Right. So he would, Clinton would frequently use the, after one of these confrontations at a public forum, then after we got in the car, you know, he would use the N-word.
Referring to jive with him being this liberal thinking individual. Seems real low class.
Well, yeah, that's Bill Clinton, Chris. That's the way he does. Everything is you know, it's this man is so good at putting on this facade, this front. And then when you see the real man, and that's one of the things that really upset me, that, you know, when you see the real man and, you know, you think this guy is, you know, his public face and his private face are, you know, 180 degrees.
Even during the campaign, there seemed to be a little bit in the 92 campaign, a degree of paranoia by the Clintons.
Yeah.
They were very, I understand, worried about the Secret Service.
True. Yeah, they would not let the Secret Service come into the governor's mansion. And they told us the reason for it is because they thought that the Bush people would have a plant in the Secret Service. It would, you know, tell the Bush people what all the Clintons' campaign was doing.
Or put wiretaps or thugs in the residence.
Yeah, they had the mansion swept on at least three occasions during the campaign.
They had people come into the governor's mansion to sweep for listening devices.
Check all the telephone lines.
Who was this, Hillary, you think, or Bill was the...
I don't know, but they were certainly paranoid about, you know, anyone finding out about their campaign strategies. And so, yes, these people also swept the headquarters, but they come in to check for listening devices.
Delving into the area of little-known facts about Bill Clinton, I was a little bit astonished to hear in previous conversations from you about Bill Clinton's relationship with Ross Perot. And if you look in that 92 campaign, and to a lesser degree, the 96 campaign, Clinton did not win either election with a majority.
Correct.
And in fact, Perot was the margin that gave Clinton the victory over Bush in the 92 election. Now, as I remember what happened, Perot was set to come into the race. He announced he was going to run for president. And then sometime during the campaign season before the Democratic Convention, or during the Democratic Convention in the summer of 92, he announces he's withdrawing from the race. He even praised the Democratic Party being revitalized. Clinton, after the Democratic Convention in New York, something like 17 or 20 points ahead of Bush in the polls, came back to Little Rock. I was told he told somebody there that he needed to get Perot in the race, that it was going to tighten. Is there any evidence you have? Oh, look, let's start. What was the relationship before 1992 between Bill Clinton and Ross Perot?
On several occasions, we would be in Dallas. We would have lunch, dinner with Ross Perot or with Ross Perot Jr. That happened on several occasions. There was a number of telephone calls that was made prior to the campaign between Bill Clinton and Ross Perot. Chris, the real interesting thing is after Ross Perot dropped out in that period of time, there was
after the Democratic convention.
Right. That,
and then Perot comes back in the race a month or two later.
Right. But in that interim period of time, there was probably no less than 10 to 15 calls that I made from the governor's mansion to Ross Perot for Bill Clinton, and received calls from Ross Perot to talk to Bill Clinton.
That's an awful lot of contact for two people that's supposed to be running against each other.
That is true.
And at the end of all of those conversations, you were not privy to what took place in those conversations.
Don't have any idea what took place. The only thing I know for a fact is that I made those calls to Ross Perot. I received those calls from Ross Perot.
And that Perot, we all know, did come back into that race in 92.
Correct.
And he didn't get a majority of votes, but he certainly had a significant number of votes.
Yeah.
About 10% of the vote.
True.
When you look at what Perot has done in 92 and 96, he's almost very quiet. There's long periods you never hear anything out of him until, or his army of volunteers, until Bill Clinton needs him in an election. Are there any suspicions you have?
I don't have enough information. It seems strange to me, Chris, that, you know, that Mr. Perot and Bill Clinton had this close relationship, and that they're, you know, running for the same office. Yes, that strikes me quite strange.
During this, the run-up to the election in 92, Clinton won, obviously, and did you feel immediately after that his personality had changed? Was he a different man? Was he treating you differently than other people now that he became president of the United States or president-elect?
He was, you know, he all of his time, or the majority of his time, was taken up. We were still, you know, receiving, up until he was elected, we still made all of his telephone calls, received all the incoming calls to the mansion. As soon as he was elected, they brought staff people in and started taking care of all the phones and installed another 8-10 lines. But up until that time, and even after he was elected, all the mail that came in, we checked all the mail, distributed it, opened all the mail. But the only change we saw is that Secret Service took him over full time, that most of his time was taken up. He had to really, really plan his sexual tryst then. He couldn't do it on the spur of the moment.
Obviously, they were getting more and more concerned after Clinton was inaugurated about you folks, the troopers, and what knowledge you had. Were you ever directly offered a job or a position or cash by Buddy Young or any intermediary for Clinton?
Was told, the message was sent, that if we would keep our mouth shut, that we could have whatever we wanted, either a U.S. Marshal's position, a FEMA director's job, a regional FEMA director's job, yes.
So the message was sent how?
Bill Clinton made the call to Nanny Ferguson, and he told him, he said, tell the guys, if they'll just, you know, stick with me, that whatever they want, they can have.
It didn't seem that things were going Clinton's way. You guys certainly didn't go his way that first year. He had the travel office scandal, the Waco disaster that's still dogging his administration, the health care fiasco that Hillary was trying to implement. And then, of course, there's the death of Vince Foster in July of 1993. He was deputy White House counsel, an intimate of certainly Hillary Clinton's, a boyhood friend to Bill Clinton's.
Yes.
He had been the personal attorney for the Clintons when he was governor. There was a lot of contact between, as you were pointing out, the relationship between Hillary and Vince when they were in Little Rock together. Now they come to Washington, and I know you didn't know Vince Foster when he was in Washington, but you knew him for many years over those 6 years you were guarding Clinton.
Correct.
I mean, he was a frequent visitor to the governor's mansion.
A frequent visitor to the governor's mansion, phone calls to
social
events. He was there. He would always come up, Chris, and he'd shake hands with you, and he'd say, Larry, how are you? Is things going good for you?
Describe him as a person.
A very outgoing, a really handsome man. He dressed well. His hair was always, you know, combed. He was a nice looking man. Not only that, but he was seemed to be a very caring man. He would always ask about your children. He would ask how things were going for you. He would always say, Larry, if you need me, if you ever need me, call me, you know. Yeah.
Did you think he was the type that would commit suicide?
No.
Were you surprised to learn that? That was the official verdict of the police.
Chris, this man is at the pinnacle of his career. You know,
had a wife and three kids.
Wife, children. You know, he's ready to really start enjoying life. You know, he's the deputy counsel at the White House. He's, you know, he's been a full partner in Rose Law Firm. You know, everything's going his way. He's got no financial problems. You know, he's got a position that probably every attorney in the world would love to have, right?
You don't believe he committed suicide?
No.
Are you concerned then that somebody so close to Bill Clinton, you suspect, may have been murdered? Does that bother you?
I'm very, very concerned knowing Vince Foster, but I didn't have. It just did not fit for this man to commit suicide. But yes, that concerns me to know that.
Does it concern your own safety? I mean, here you've been speaking out about, obviously, if Foster was murdered, he was murdered for a reason. Somebody felt he was a threat. He certainly had a lot of intimate knowledge about the Clintons. And we know on the night of his death, various officials close to the Clintons, Bernie Nussbaum, Maggie Williams, Patsy Thomason, Dan Lasker's ex-employee, were all in his office rifling through papers. It's been alleged by a Secret Service officer that they removed documents.
Yeah, that concerns me. And what concerns me even more, you know, is that no one's had to answer for this, Chris. No one has had to answer for those documents being removed, rifling through the files, and all of those questions that are still unanswered.
Well, it seems to me that if no one's had to answer about Vince Foster, no one has to answer for any of the other scandals, FBI, Filegate, Travelgate, because if a key witness could be murdered, as you suggest, then why should anyone talk?
Yeah, that's not an incentive to talk, is it?
Great place to end. Yeah, it's not an incentive to talk, is it? So, and that goes right through everything. This is the final part of this is going to pick up next week, and he drops a bomb that I'll just leave you hanging. That is something I'd never heard, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. I got to do some more research, but the remainder of time we're going to finish up with Mr. Seal, Dan Lasseter. We'll have to wait until next week, because he's another guy that you may have never heard of. So back to Mr. Seal. How much more evidence is needed to prove that the CIA, a branch of the U.S. government, is one of the largest drug traffickers in the country, if not the largest? The Seal didn't work alone. He claimed that he employed more than 60 people. Their flights came with utter immunity, protected or fixed, as one law enforcement agent called them, by the collusion of U.S. intelligence and other agencies under the guise of national security. Seal's protection by the U.S. government during his cocaine flights was so extensive that in 1996, a former Seal associate would testify to congressional investigators how the operation had been provided by CIA, quote, security for flights in and out of the U.S., including a highly classified encoding device to evade air defense and surveillance measures. The money Seal was making boggles the mind. He casually admitted to federal agents that he took $75 million in the early 1980s, and under court questioning said he made at least $25 million in 1981 alone. He was working with major league players, and the U.S. government knew it because they were involved. For some time, the FBI, DEA, and other agencies had been tracking Seal's activities as part of an investigation into internal cocaine smuggling, codenamed Coin Roll. Even when the heat did come down, someone always stepped in to protect Seal. One time, an assistant U.S. attorney in Asa Hutchinson's office had mentioned that orders had come from Miami to, quote, shut down the MENA investigation that was currently being planned. Who was pulling the strings? Well, Seal, the flagrant cocaine smuggler, ran his operations in MENA, Arkansas, but he had friends in Washington, D.C. Now the picture is becoming clearer. Arkansas State Police investigator Russell Welch's diary contained the following entry for June 4th, 1985. An agent from the DEA informed me in the strictest confidence that it was believed within his department that Barry Seal is flying weapons to Central and Southern America. In return, he is allowed to smuggle what he wanted back into the United States. Why the hands-off policy? Because Seal at this time was in close contact with Oliver North, who acknowledged their relationship in his memoir. Blah, 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 blah. Everyone knew what was happening. What were they turning a blind eye to? We should take in the kind of everybody, you know, they got the drugs down, they got the drugs back, guns down. That's how drug trafficking in America worked. All signed, sealed, and delivered by your own U.S. government via the CIA. Barry Seal was a drug dealer working for the Medellin cartel, as well as the CIA and the DEA. And do you think things have gotten better or worse? Do you think they've pumped up involvement and the numbers of drugs and money since then? Of course. While parading around as a super patriots, What we really saw was extensive collusion between criminals and our own government. For it is clear at some point, Seal, Bush, and the CIA became allies in propaganda war to secure Contra funds from Congress. Doing on time here. All right. To further illustrate the link between Seal and the CIA, guess where the infamous drug smuggler laundered much of his money? He placed much of it in the CIA's favorite criminal bank, BCCI. Seal had several sizable accounts in BCCI-affiliated banks, including a branch of the Fuji Bank in the Cayman Islands. Likewise, Seal was well acquainted with the Arkansas financiers who traveled in Bill and Hillary circles. He was already a businessman of note in Arkansas, with an address book containing some of the state's well-known names and contacts in Little Rock's banks and brokerage houses, and what a fellow CIA operative called a night depository, where bags of cash dropped from green flights onto a ranch of politically and financially prominent Arkansas family. It says Seth Ward. An associate, a pilot who came with SEAL from Louisiana in 1982, would later testify about their first weeks in Arkansas. When they were introduced to pivotal figures in state government and business, Barry Seal knew them all, and they all knew him, the Clinton machine. There was no limit on cooperation by the good old boys, a federal agent would say, of Clinton's Arkansas friends. So much we got to go here. Okay, got 2-3 pages. All right, we can do this. Remember the kind of money we're talking about. In one trial, Barry Seal estimated that before becoming a DEA informant, his income from smuggling had been between $60 and $100 million, and that it had not dropped off after he began cooperating with the DEA. Do you think huge bond houses and banks in Little Rock, especially those controlled by Stevens Incorporated, which ran the whole state, wouldn't notice these transactions? Who in Arkansas is moving millions of dollars in cash? Some guy working at a convenience store in Fayetteville? Of course, Stevens Incorporated noticed this huge influx of money because Stevens was up to its neck in BCCI. They were working together. George Bush Sr., the Clintons, Stevens, Barry Seal, BCCI, Oliver North, and the banks around MENA that laundered the money. What it became was a, quote, vivid portrait not only of a major criminal conspiracy around MENA, but also of the unmistakable shadow of government complicity, unquote. Let's see. Let's focus in on how Barry Seal was pulling off these escapades. One of his specialties was to retrofit the planes used to smuggle drugs. Specifically, his fleet had secret fuel bladders installed in the floor of the aircraft to extend their flight range. The work was done so professionally that the inspectors from the DEA and U.S. Customs invariably failed to detect it. Trapdoors were fitted so that he could drop duffel bags of cocaine in mid-flight before landing empty. The police never knew where to look because he did not decide where to make the drop until the last moment, using his state-of-the-art gear to give immediate Loran coordinates to his helicopter crews. In addition to all these retrofitted planes with special plumbing and drop doors, SEAL also had 9 aircraft rigged with sophisticated electronic equipment at a cost of $750,000. The bill was paid in cash. Seal was so enamored with what he'd accomplished at MENA that at one point he brazenly bought drug cartel kingpin Jorge Ochoa to Arkansas to show off his operation. Doesn't that make you proud of what Bill and Hillary did in their state, virtually turning it into a narco republic that hosted international drug traffickers as honored guests? One other tale of intrigue is appropriate in showing how closely tied Barry Seal was to Oliver North and his network. In the summer of 1985, Seal decided to sell his C-123K cargo plane for $250,000. The buyer was the same CIA contractor, Harold Doane, from whom Seal had acquired the plane a year earlier. The plane later upended in the service of Oliver North's Contra resupply program and entered aviation history on October 3rd, 1986, when it was shot down over Nicaragua airspace and its cargo kicker. Oh boy, Eugene Hassenfuss, there's a name I haven't, oh goodness gracious. He was the pilot, was taken into custody by the Sandinistas and paraded before the world as living proof of the Reagan administration's war against the country. All the dots are now connected. Barry Seal bought his drug running plane from the CIA and resold it to the CIA. Oliver North took charge of it for his Contra Arms for Drugs network. Then Eugene Hassenfuss was shot down in Barry Seal's plane, which took off from the drug capital of America, Mena, Arkansas. On top of that, at least some of the aircraft in Seal's smuggling fleet, which included a Learjet, helicopters, and former U.S. military experts, were also outfitted with avionics and other equipment by yet another company in turn linked to Air America. If that's not enough, the specific aircraft which Seal used to fly drugs in and then sold to the CIA, which crashed in Nicaragua, had during the Vietnam War belonged to Air America Incorporated, CIA proprietary airline that had flown guns to the Laotian Mayo and Long Tien while bringing heroin back. Lastly, documents found on board the aircraft and seized by the Sandinistas included logs linking the planes with Area 51. Area 51. Oh, my goodness. As for Barry Seal, his life, like so many others in this line of work or involved with the Clintons, ended tragically on February 17, 1986. Seal was murdered in Baton Rouge by Colombian hitmen. Why was Seal liquidated? After hearing of Seal's death, a DEA spokesman said, "There was a contract out on him, and everyone knew it. He was to have been a crucial witness in the biggest case in DEA history." So he turned state's evidence. There's kind of stuff he's kind of skipping over here, but others knew the truth. Others knew that with as much incriminating information as Seal had in his possession on Oliver North, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and the CIA, it was only a matter of time until he met his end. A longtime friend and smuggler from Louisiana went so far to say that Seal had been set up for the kill. He and others speculated that Seal had been positioned to be killed because he knew too much about illegal U.S. government operations. Let's see. Further, they had others assisting them in covering up the murder. After Seal was killed in a spray of bullets, the FBI went into the Baton Rouge Police Department and literally and physically seized evidence, the contents of his car trunk from the Baton Rouge police. In fact, the Baton Rouge police probably would have had to draw their guns to keep possession of that trunk. There's one last catch. Over the years, some have hypothesized that Seal got off because of a leak from Oliver North. Due to peculiar legal decisions, Seal was living by court order in a halfway house, and it was North who helped leak the information about Seal to the media, blowing Seal's cover. Good night, everybody.
Ah, my favorite brain soup. Cream.
Broadcasting has a sister site where you can find insightful articles from the past and present, the latest in health and wellness, research, analysis of current events, profound poetry, amazing artwork, lots of videos and podcasts from other content creators, and so much more. We are in a struggle to awaken as many people as possible, put an end to our enslavement in this toxic culture, and create a future where we can be happy, healthy, and free. Go to renegadetribune.com, browse the great content, and do consider joining the crew in publishing your own original work.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Right time find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl. Black as the night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was strong for this Mexican maid. I was in love, but in vain I could tell.